Let's start the recording. Okay, exciting. We are on Hey Ahmed Aleph this week. So that's 5A. I'd like to say we are on the fifth daf, but really we started on Beis Ahmed Aleph on 2A. But if it makes us feel better, we're on the fifth page. We're on Hey Ahmed Aleph now. So again, we're really going to talk about a question. Actually, Jenny, you'll appreciate this because Ben, your husband, he brought up a question, I think, in one of our first classes. He asked, let's say you have two witnesses and they are found guilty of Hazama. They are found guilty of being Edom Zomimin, but they were lying, but it happens to be that they were actually right in the end of the day. They didn't know they were right. They did so in order to lie, but really everything is okay. So would the Edom Zomimin still be put to death if the defendant actually is put to death also and he really was guilty of murdering someone, let's say it was? So that is a question that we are going to deal with tonight. The answer is in some cases yes, in some cases no. So you'll make sure to pass along the answer to him after tonight. All right, excellent. So here we go. Actually, we made a little progress at the end of last time. We went down the Amud a bit on Hamad Aleph. So we're not at the first Mishnah, but we're actually starting with the second Mishnah tonight. And, you know, for anyone who is with us for Mishnayos on Fridays, I see Gloria over there. And I guess Phyllis will jump on at some point. So you'll know this Mishnah already. But it's not a complicated Mishnah. Actually, if one is learning Mishnayos Makos, the Mishnah we're about to learn is split up into two separate Mishnahs. But we get two for the price of one tonight. So we give you all the best deals here. So here we go. We are the second Mishnah on the page. Maybe that's 5 to the 2nd power in the art scroll, I'm imagining. That's my estimate, if that helps you. Okay. So it should probably be 5 to the 2nd power in art scroll.
Well, it's actually on 5. It's still the bottom of the first power.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The bottom of that. Okay. So for those who it helps orient. Here we go. Mishnah. Ein ha'edim natsim zomimin. Okay, so remember, a lot of the Mishnayos that we are going to learn, we have already learned these concepts. Either the Gemara referenced them, or I made sure to bring them up. That way we had the necessary background for understanding the earlier Gemaras. So some of the things we're about to say in this Mishnah actually should sound somewhat familiar. So, Eina Edim Nasin Zomin, Ache Yezimu Es Atzman. So, they themselves, not just their testimony, but they themselves have to be disqualified. Now, what does that mean? They themselves need to be disqualified. Ketzad, Amru Me'idin Ano Be'ish Ploni, Shahorag Esa Nefesh. Let's say they testify that Reuben killed Shimon. Amru Lehem, Heach Atem Me'idin. Let's say the second pair of witnesses comes in. They're saying the first pair of witnesses, you're a bunch of liars. You're committing perjury. How do we know that you're lying? This is the important detail. If they say, because the victim was with us on the day you claim the murder took place, or the murderer was, or the person you're claiming was the murderer, was with us on the day that you claim you saw the murder take place. Ein Elu Zomimin. They do not become Edom Zomimin. Why? Because they themselves did not become disqualified. Their testimony, they have a few holes in the story, but they're not inherently disqualified from testifying in this case. However, what rather is the case of Edom Zomimin? Avol Amru Lahem, Heach Atem Me'idin. How can you testify? You two people testify. You were with us in California when the murder you claim took place in New York. Then they become a zomim, and they can be put to death based on their testimony because it's the witnesses who would have had no way of testifying on the case that they said took place. That is the end of the first part of the Mishnah. Now, and again, if you are learning Mishnayos Makos, as a few of us do on Friday afternoons. So this actually would be the end of the Mishnah. But again, we get two for the price of one over here. Buy one, get one free. So we're going to move on, and we're going to do the next Mishnah, which is all included in here.
But if just one quick question. In the first case, mm-hmm. they're not eating Zomami, but if their testimony is found out to be false or whatever, they're still liable for false testimony of sorts? Or?
Right. So what they would – thank you for clarifying. So what Henry is saying is they're not eating Zomami, but they're still Eidei Sheker. And as we learned, Eidei Sheker, they should get Malkus for committing perjury. So they would get the standard 39 lashes instead of getting whatever particular punishment they claimed the defendant deserved. Thanks for clarifying that, Henry. Okay. So now...
I also have a question, though, on the first part before you go to the second.
Sure.
When they say you were with us, do they actually have to be in the same place? What if, let's say, I just saw him, you know, I saw him out my window, or I was going, you know, by a store and I saw through the window that he was there. Does that count?
Okay, very good. So this Gemara, the Gemara we're going to see, is going to start touching on the idea of how do we define the same place? Not the Gemara okay. we're going to see tonight, but a later Gemara is going to deal with cases of, let's say, one witness was watching it from one window, another witness was watching from the other window. So that's going to actually be a case we're going to talk about later on, not tonight, but soon. But tonight we're actually going to discuss what does it mean to be in the same place. So the case that's going to come up in the Gemara momentarily is, let's say they were at this big palace or this big building, but the witnesses were on one side of the building. The murder took place on the other side of the building. So we're going to see, you know, is that considered the same place? Could they see one side from the other? So that's going to be part of the discussion, and that will begin to address, I think, the point that you're raising. Okay? Okay. So, bo acherim v'hazimum. Bo acherim v'hazimum. Now, let's say, you know, it could be like a circus over here. So, two witnesses come in. They say, Reuben killed Shimon. A second pair comes in and they say, no, Imano ha'yishim malkum ploni, et cetera, et cetera. You were with us in another place. We are on 5A for those who are joining us now. We were in another place. And so they invalidate, they claim that the first pair are Edom Zomamin, and they successfully make them Edom Zomamin. Now imagine now a third pair comes in. The second pair again says, oh, you were also with us in a different location on that day at the same time. Then a fourth pair comes in. You were also with us at the same time. So, Boachim Rezimum, Boachim Rezimum. Each pair that comes in, the second pair of witnesses keeps claiming that they also are Edom Zomamin. So the first opinion in the Mishnah says, "Afilu me'akul miharvu." If they convict up to 100 or more pairs of witnesses for being Edom Zomamin, they'll be believed, and those 100 pairs of witnesses will be put to death based on their testimony. Now, many of us are saying that's ridiculous. It's got to be some sort of conspiracy, some sort of plot going on here. What, every single pair of witnesses that comes in was with them in the same day at the same time? That's a little bit absurd, you know, where they all have like the same, you know, Sima Shas or Comic-Con convention going on. You know, how are they all in the same place at the same time? So Rabbi Yehuda Omer, istotisizu. This is, they're making this up. There's a plot taking place. It's a conspiracy. Rather, they're only believed in regards to the first pair of witnesses that comes in. They are not believed to claim that any future pairs of witnesses are Edom Zomamin, according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Okay. Now, what's the question that's bothering us about Rabbi Yehuda's opinion? J.K. Jenny, I see you nodding. You want to tell us what's the question?
Yeah. The first pair may not be Edom Zomamin at all, and the second pair could be the Edom Zomamin trying to get everyone in trouble. They could be the ones who are lying.
So Frek Reb Jenny Akasha, which is the question of the Gemara as well. Even the first pair of witnesses should be let off the hook. Once we see that these guys are a bunch of conspiring witnesses, that there's a plot taking place over here, they shouldn't be believed in regards to the first pair. So very good. The Gemara on the top of Hayim Abayis says that, and hopefully we'll get to that tonight. But in case we don't, I just didn't want to leave that as a glaring question. The Gemara recognizes that difficulty, and we'll see if it really resolves it or not. Okay. let's get into the Gemara. And I think, you know, a number of the questions that we are all thinking of and raising already, God willing, will be addressed to a certain extent in the Gemara. But again, you know, at any point, I'll try to pause at certain points for people to ask questions. But of course, if at any point there's something which is just lacking clarity to just basic understanding of the Gemara, please jump in and let me know. Here we go. So we know Hani Mili. The first thing that the Gemara wants to discover is, well, where do we get this rule that in order to be Edom Zomimin, the Edom, the witnesses themselves, need to become invalidated? Not just the murderer was with us on that day or the victim was with us on the day. Why is it to be Dafka, the witnesses were with us in a different place at a different time on that day? So where do we derive that from? What's the source, the Gemara asks? Two opinions. Amar Ravana da Amar Kra. I can deduce from the verse. It says, "Fina aid sheker ha'aid, sheker anaba achiv." So there's an extra word of witness. It didn't need to say aid twice. "Fina aid sheker ha'aid." We didn't need the first mentioning of a witness. The extraneous word of witness in the Torah was put in there deliberately to teach us that specifically the witnesses themselves need to become disqualified in order for them to become Edom Zomimin. Ad shetishaker gufa shel edus, until they themselves, gufa themselves, become invalidated, that they don't even qualify to testify about such a case. That's one approach to where we derive the source. Another approach, it's not a machlokus, it's not an argument, it's two different ways to derive and arrive at the same point. Devei Rabbi Yishmael Tana, Lanos Bo Sara. So what does Sara mean? Sara means like to remove. Ad Shetisareh Gufa Shel Edus. Until the point that the second pair of witnesses is able to destroy and remove any havamina, any initial thought that we should be hearing testimony from these people. Once you say you aren't even in the same state when this act took place, these guys don't even belong in the courtroom anymore. That's what makes them Edom Zomimin. So two different derivations from a close reading of the biblical text, but it arrives at the same conclusion, both supporting the Mishnah that the witnesses themselves need to become invalidated. That's the first part of the Gemara right there. I think pretty straightforward. Okay, so now we're going to get a bunch of questions about how do we define Makom Ploni, right? I've been giving a very easy case until now. I said the murder took place in New York. They were in California on the same day. Well, you know, let's take a case. Let's say, God forbid, a murder takes place on the campus of a Gudah Shalom. God forbid, right? But let's use that as an example because that's a building and campus that hopefully we are familiar with or will become familiar with once again once we're able to come back. So hopefully our memory still serves us. So imagine I say, a murder took place at a Gudah Shalom in the parking lot. But the witnesses say, well, at that same time, you were with us on the Strawberry Hill entrance of a Gudah Shalom. So the question is, can you really see from the parking lot from the Strawberry Hill entrance? That might be an issue. You know, I may have been at a Gudah Shalom when that murder took place, but if I was on a completely different side of a Gudah Shalom at the time it took place, and I couldn't see the murder take place, even though I'm in the same area even, that might still be enough for me to be invalidated as Edom Zomimin. So let's jump in the Gemara and see what we see. Amar Rava. Let's just make sure to mute ourselves if possible. There we go. Okay. Amar Rava. Bo Shnaiv Amru. So two witnesses come and say, the Mizrach Bira Harak Ploni Es Hanefesh. So on the eastern side of Bira, Bira is like a palace or some sort of important building. I'm not sure actually, how does our article translate Bira? I'm curious. Like Shushan HaBira, right?
Palace.
Okay, good. Okay, Barshik Yivanti. Sorry, it's like Shushan HaBira. Ah, there's our connection to Purim right over there. Okay, great. We were Yotze. So they say the murder took place on the eastern side of this palace. Harklonius and Ephesh. But then Ubo Shnayim Va'amru, then another pair of witnesses come and they say, Follow by Myriv Bira Imanu Hayisem. You are with us on the western side of the palace, right? So this is like the murder took place on the eastern side of Agudat Shalom. Actually, that works out. Yeah, the eastern side, like the parking lot. But you are on the western side, on the Strawberry Hill entrance of the Bira at the same time. So Chazinon, Ikdekaimi b'Myriv Bira, Michsa Chazul Mizrach Bira, Ein Elu Zomen. So if I could see from the western side to the eastern side, I wouldn't be invalidated as Adam Zomerman. Why? Because I could see from that side to the other. Actually, for a good Hashem, it's a little difficult because I guess if you're like aligned properly, you're close to Colonial, you actually could get a view of the parking lot from there. So it's a good Hashem might be like a more difficult involved example to use. Ein Elu Zomen. V'imlav hare Elu Zomen. So the question is, if they could see each other, if they could see the murder, even from the other side, then they're still valid witnesses, not Ein Zomen. But if it's impossible to see it from the other side, then they would be invalid witnesses. Well, the Gemara says, pshita, that's pretty obvious. You know, it didn't take all those years of rabbinical school to figure that one out. So ma detema lechash nahora barya. I would have said, you know, maybe he has really good eyesight. All right, imagine you're standing on the other side of Strawberry Hill. You're ready to cross the street, and you claim that the murder took place all the way at the picket fence at the end of the parking lot near the entrance. So you'd have to have pretty good eyesight. I think so. I'm trying to think. I think you would need good eyesight probably to see a murder take place all the way from over there. I could be wrong. Maybe just me with bad eyesight. So you'd have to see from there. But maybe I would say, okay, you know, in Hachinami, maybe the witnesses are among the few who have this elvish eyesight that they can see long distances. So no, Kamash Malan, the Gemara is telling us, Rava's coming to tell us, we don't take these kind of things into account. Rather, so there's actually two ways to interpret the Gemara here. I think it's a machlokis, Ritva, and Tosa Mishantz. So this is the two ways to learn it. One havamina, one way to understand this, is that I would have thought we would put the defendant to death on the basis that maybe the witnesses can see from a very far distance. Kamash Malan, the Gemara comes to tell me, in the end, we're not going to put someone to death on the basis of maybe these witnesses having eagle eyesight. The other way to interpret this line in the Gemara is, we would never have thought to put somebody to death on the basis that maybe they could see a far distance. That's absurd, right? When suffering the fashos, when it comes to any kind of doubts, we have to lean air to the sign of caution. So rather, maybe the Havamina, which is what the Ritva says, I believe, is that the witnesses would not be put to death because maybe they have really good eyesight. We say, no, they don't, you know, they can't see those far distances. We're not taking this 0.001% chance into account. Rather, these are conspiring witnesses. They're Adam Zoman, and they are put to death as a result, since it would not be possible for any normal person to see from the west side of the Bira to the east side of the Bira. That is the conclusion of the Gemara there.
Rabbi, isn't it really the distinction? You have the second set of witnesses saying, you know, this guy was too far away, couldn't have seen it, versus, but that's still possible. It's plausible. He's got the eagle eyesight. Or this witness was on the other side of the building and was obstructed. It was impossible for her to see it. And so the solution, the penalty would fit whether someone was clearly lying. I couldn't have possibly seen it because there was a obstructed view versus, no, I could have seen it. It was just at a distance. And so it's the quality of the accusation as to impugning the witness, which would determine whether or not they were obviously lying or maybe they were telling the truth.
Right. So definitely if there's a building interposing between you and where the murder took place and there's zero chance you could have seen it, the Gemara isn't entertaining that. And that's why the Gemara asks, pshita, it doesn't even make sense that that's even a question. The only question is, what if there is a very minuscule chance that I could have seen the murder? Do we take that minuscule chance into account, or we say that's not even, doesn't reach the threshold of a suffix. It doesn't reach a threshold of a doubt. So since it doesn't reach a threshold, we ignore that possible detail.
But couldn't we have, I mean, I would think that they would probe and try to prove whether or not, if the witness says, I have great eyesight, I could see from 500 yards, you know, who it was, I saw their face, I know what they were wearing. Couldn't you, you know, probe that witness? Couldn't the court ask questions to try to determine whether or not that witness could plausibly have seen that far? Or would they just throw it out of hand and say, forget it, we can't really credit that testimony, but you know, if it's possible enough that we're not going to penalize you for it.
Okay, good. So Tosas Shantz's opinion, unlike the Ritva, is what you're saying, which is because there is that possibility, we're definitely not putting the defendant to death, but also because of this doubt, we can't put the witnesses to death either. So that actually is an opinion among the commentaries. So, you know, apparently you disagree with the Ritva, but you have some of the Bali Tosos that are on your side. So that will label that your school of thought there, Jeremy. I see, Howard, you put something in the chat. So let me just see what your question is over there. Would the witness have to see the defendant being warned in the case of a murder? Very good. We will talk about this in a later Gemara. But essentially, right, if you want to put someone to death for committing murder, as very good, you're bringing what we learned last time, that there needs to be hasra, there needs to be a warning. So we will, God willing, talk about what happens if you see the murder, but you didn't see the hasra. What if the witnesses give the hasra, but they didn't, but they weren't the same ones who saw the murder take place. If my recollection is correct, a later Gemara actually will deal with those nuances. So I appreciate you bringing up now, God willing, in one of our soon future shiurim, we will address that particular question. But there does need to be a hasra. You are correct. Okay, let's make some progress in the Gemara. The Gemara is going to give one more similar case, and then we're going to have to, what they call in Yiddish in yeshivas, hold cup. We're going to have to keep a cheshbon. We're going to have to keep track of the back and forth in the Gemara a little bit. Okay, but nothing more complicated than anything we've handled until now. V'amar Rava, let's continue. Bo shnai v'amar besura b'tzafra b'cha b'shabasa harak ploni es hanefesh. The first pair of witnesses come in and they say, in surah, in the morning, on Sunday morning, Reuven killed Shimon. Ubo shnaiv amru, and then two witnesses come and they say, b'fanya b'cha b'shabasa imanu hayisim b'nahar da. But how could you have seen that? Later that evening, we saw you in a different city, in the city of Nahar Da. So this is interesting. They're not saying you were with us at exactly the same time as the murder. But what they are saying is that we saw you only a few hours later in a completely different location that you would not have been able to get to if you were actually in the location of the murder at the time you claimed it happened. So what do? We make a similar evaluation. We see if it's possible for them to travel from Surah, where they claim the murder took place, to Nahar Da, where they were seen later that evening. If so, if it's possible to make that journey over the course of those few hours, lo havu zomamin, they would not be Adam Zomamin then. They have a good alibi. Be lav havu zomamin, but if it's impossible to make such a trek to be in Surah in the morning and then Nahar Da in the evening, clearly they weren't in Surah to see the murder happen, and that renders them Adam Zomamin. Now, once again, pshita, I could have figured this out on my own. I didn't have to come to Gemara Shir tonight to figure this one out. Ma'udetema, what would have I thought to say had I not been told this? Lechush legamla parcha. I would be concerned that there's a possibility of the flying camels. You heard me correct, the flying camels. What are the flying camels? What are gamla parcha? So, does our school translate it that way also, like the flying
camels? No, that's exactly, yeah.
The flying camels, right, okay. It sounds like some sort of like racing team. So flying camels basically is, you know, you take the express bus. The Gamaparka were these camels that moved so fast that they were called the flying camels. They went at such extreme speeds, right? You took the instead of a regular jet, you took a Concorde to get where you needed to get to. You know, go these. If anyone watched Spaceballs, you know, like they go to ludicrous speed to get you where you need to go to. Okay, whoever got that reference, you got it. Most people didn't. Okay, I see Sarah laughing. It was worth it for that. Okay,
loves you.
Light speed or warp speed, if that helps better. Yes, Zadie.
In World War One, there was the Sopwith Camel. It was a fighter aircraft. It can get from one place to another place at about 90 miles an hour.
Oh, okay. So maybe that's what the Gemara is talking about. A little anachronistic, but it works. So I would have said, hey, you know what? Maybe they had in their back pocket one of these flying camels. And that's how they got from Suretz Narda in no time. Kamash Malan, again, same idea. If we have no reason to assume that they had access to this special breed of flying camels to get them to where they need to go to, we're not going to buy that alibi. And they are Edom Zomimin. So certainly the defendant's not being put to death. And a Machlokas Rishonim, possibly the Edom Zomimin actually become bona fide Edom Zomimin and can be put to death on the basis of lying in court. Okay, that's the end of that section of the Gemara. Now, I want to give a little bit of introduction to the next piece. What we are about to learn in the next piece requires us to know one important distinction. And if we know this important distinction, the Gemara should go by smoothly, God willing. And the good news is this distinction we've actually mentioned a number of times before. There's a difference between testifying in court, I saw Reuven kill Shimon, therefore Reuven should be put to death, versus coming into court and saying, I saw that Reuven was sentenced already to death for killing Shimon. The difference is testifying on a maisa, on an action, on something that took place, versus testifying on a gemar din, on a sentencing that already took place. Now, what is the difference whether I testify on one or the other? So this gets to the case that that Ben asked through Jenny many weeks ago, which is it possible that witnesses could be Edom Zomimin, but also be right at the same time? So in a case where they're testifying on an action, it can happen. Where they're testifying on a Gemar Din, on a sentencing, it's not going to happen. What is
they don't actually
mean?
See it.
What was that, Phyllis?
So they don't actually see it? Or they
so
do
gonna,
see
I'm
it?
I'm going to explain the case right now. But just in the abstract, that's the distinction we need to know. Testifying on an action, on a deed being done, I saw Reuven kill Shimon, versus testifying on, I was at a court case where I saw Reuven get sentenced for killing Shimon. That's the distinction we need to know. And
why would anybody need to testify about that?
Why would, oh, well, remember our case from like the second shiur where somebody runs from one city to another? So if, right, let's say Reuven runs from Eilat to Akko to northern Israel. So I said, wait, I was at that case and I was on vacation over there and I was scuba diving and I saw, and then I was walking by the court that day and I saw the sentencing tape. Like, it doesn't really happen like that. So then I go back to Akko and he's in Akko now. And so I go to the court over there and say, by the way, that guy was sentenced in Eilat already. He should be put to death. That's kind of how a case like that would take place.
Thank you.
Okay, good. So let's go into the Gemara now that we know this distinction. It'll become clear why I'm bringing this up as we learn through it. Okay. V'amar Rava, bo shnayim v'amru. So here's what's taking place. The witnesses are coming in on a Tuesday. In all these cases, they're coming in on Tuesday to court. And they are saying as follows. On Sunday, Reuven killed Shimon. But then another pair of witnesses come in, also on Tuesday, during this court case. And they say, you were with us on Sunday. You couldn't see the murder take place. But on Monday, the murder took place. So the first pair of witnesses, they are correct. Reuven did murder Shimon, but it wasn't on the same day that they claimed it took place. It took place a day later. Or even, I'll give you an even bigger chiddush. Let's say They say, Ela afilu amru erev Shabbos harag ploni esan nevesh. The second pair witnesses come and say, the murder actually took place a few days before you claim the murder happened. Neharigin, the first pair of witnesses are put to death. Why? Deba'idna dekomisade, at the moment that they testified on Tuesday, gavra lav bar kitalahu, since they were testifying on him murdering somebody, this man was a free man. He was not being put to death. He was going to live to a ripe old age. And because these two witnesses in the first group came in, they turned this man into a bar kitala, into a dead man, because the court sentenced him to death. And so when the second pair of witnesses come in and they say, you guys lied about the date, but actually it did take place. So the nidon, the defendant, is also still put to death. The defendant's put to death. The first pair of witnesses are put to death. And the second pair, well, obviously they walk free because there's nothing wrong with what they did. Because now the first pair might say, wait a minute. We were right. I mean, we got the date wrong, but we were right, right? You can't really call us liars. Well, they were trying to declare him a bar kitala, a dead man, before he had a status of being a dead man. So therefore, actually, it's not like no harm, no foul. They caused him to get a status of being a dead man before he was deserving of it. So therefore, they are put to death.
So Rabbi, but in that example, though, the defendant who was accused of murder and was put to death, he actually committed the murder, just not the way that the witnesses claimed that he committed the murder?
So, right, exactly. So what we believe, this is what our understanding, is that the witnesses, they actually thought, they didn't really think Reuven killed Shimon. They, for whatever reasons, they wanted to claim it happened. Happens to be, the coincidence, ironically, is that it actually did happen. But we know that they didn't really know that it happened, because otherwise they would have testified that it happened on the date it actually occurred. So it's tough luck on them. They're trying to put this guy to death, and it really did happen. They thought they had to make the whole thing up, but it really did happen. So here's what's happening, right? Let's take the logic we learned from our first year. So there is a verdict out there. They created a verdict. So who's it going to go to? The verdict created by the testimony of the first witnesses goes to them, and the verdict created by the second witnesses goes to the defendant. So that's why both of them are put to death in the end of the day. Now, here's the thing. This is great. This is a chiddush. You know, if had I not come to shiur tonight, I probably would have had doubts about this. I would not have known that on my own, right? That was a question we had in one of our first shiurim. But the Gemara says, well, the thing is, if we took time to learn Mishnayos earlier, we actually would have come to the same conclusion. My Kamashmalan, actually, it's on Vavamad Beis. So in only a few weeks, we're actually going to get up to this. My Kamashmalan, Tanina, a Mishnah, only a few pages later, says, Lefikach nintzeis achas mehen zomemes, hu vehein nahargin vehashnia petura. There's a Mishnah which literally gives us the same case later on. So here's the thing. Rava's an Amora. Rava's a few generations later. Why do I need an Amora who lived later to teach me something that the Mishnah already codified, that the Mishnah already told us? The Mishnah already told us this case. Why do I need the Gemara? Why do I need Rava to come and tell it to me? What chiddush, what novelty is he coming to add that I would not have known had I learned the Mishnah that told me the exact same thing? Seifa Masha Enkin Begmar Din Isterchale. What do I need this for? Let's say I add in, I switch one little factor here. Instead of the witnesses testifying on the Maisa, on seeing Reuven kill Shimon, they're testifying that they saw Reuven was sentenced to death for murdering Shimon. By switching this one detail, it's going to flip around the whole case. And this is what Rava is coming to tell me that I would not have known from the Mishnah. Now, what does that mean? Let's go through it. Let's say, Bo Shnayim, Va'amr Bechabesh Abasa Nigmar Dino Shalploni. So again, this is in court on, you know, Tuesday afternoon. They're in Beis Din. And the witnesses, the first pair is saying, on Sunday, we saw that Reuven was sentenced for killing Shimon. You were with us on Sunday. You couldn't have seen the sentencing take place. Rather, on Erev Shabbos, on Friday, he was sentenced. Even if they claim the sentencing took place later on. So I would think this is similar to the last case, where the first pair of witnesses, since they're claiming that this person should be put to death sooner than the second pair, they also should be put to death. But no. They're not put to death. Why? Because what's happening is, since they're testifying on a sentencing, so when I testify on a maisa, when I testify on a deed taking place, Beis Din needs to rule a verdict. So if I see Reuven kill Shimon, Reuven is not immediately culpable for capital punishment. Beis Din needs to create a verdict. They need to rule that this person's chayiv misa, that this person should be put to death. So therefore, if I testify before a second pair of witnesses to put this guy to death, and Beis Din creates a verdict earlier to put him to death, then I'm responsible for claiming that I'm responsible for putting him to death. But over here, since the second pair of witnesses is claiming that the Gemar Din already happened, that he was already sentenced to death in a different court, even on Monday, since today is now Tuesday, the first pair of witnesses aren't really making him a bar ketula. They're not making him into a dead man earlier than he really was before. Because the second pair of witnesses are coming in and they're saying two things. They're saying, number one, you guys are a bunch of liars. But number two, they're saying, you guys are lying about when it took place, but they're corroborating that there indeed was a Gemar Din. There was a sentencing that took place even on Monday, anytime prior to Tuesday. So when the first pair comes in, they lie on Tuesday, they're not actually making that defendant into a dead man, because from the testimony of the second pair of witnesses, we already know that he was sentenced to be a dead man prior to Tuesday. That's why this first pair of witnesses will not be put to death for lying. As Henry pointed out, they'll probably get Malchus, they'll get 39 lashes for being 80 sheker, but they will not get capital punishment because they testified on a sentencing instead of on the action. Now, I want to pause over here, take any questions, because I realize I just shot out a lot of things, so I want to make sure to clarify it. Okay.
Is the man really dead?
Legally speaking, he is. Well, at what point are you asking, is he really dead?
Well, the first one it is not put to death because the court did not rule yet on whether he's guilty of murder or not. So, you're innocent until proven guilty.
Right.
And the second one didn't actually see a murder, but said that they know that he was put to death. In other words, they assumed he was put to death.
Is that not right? Good. I'm glad you're bringing this up.
Missing something?
They're not saying that he was already put to death. They're saying that he was already sentenced.
Okay.
If this man he's
like a dead man already at the time
right.
once he's sentenced.
Okay, I meant figuratively, when I say it, right, thank you, Harris. When I say
he's not dead,
I mean like, you know, like in the Wild West where you say he's a dead man, you know, like.
Okay. So he's not dead.
Okay.
So he's not dead in either case.
Nope, he's not dead. We are determining if he should be put to death. If he was already dead, there'd be no court case here. There'd be nothing to talk about.
I understand, but what I don't understand is how the second set of Adim gets put to death.
No. The second pair, they're good guys. The first pair gets put to death because the second pair claimed that the first pair was lying about the timing of when it took place. And since they lied about the timing, chances are they didn't actually even know that a murder took place. Coincidentally, they got it right, but not for the right reason.
I don't know. I'm still not getting that the guy was actually murdered, that he actually died. I missed something along the way.
Okay. So I'm happy to find some time outside of the Shear. I'm not sure if I know exactly the detail that's missing. So I'm happy to follow up afterwards to see what that was. I see a few questions here in the chat. So let's see, Jeremy, you said, so it sounds like the issue is whether the witness's testimony is the proximate cause of the defendant's death sentence. Yeah, I would put it like that. Meaning, are they causing him to be put to death? So in the case where the whole discussion is about when the sentencing took place, these witnesses are not causing him to get the death penalty because he indeed already received the verdict for the death penalty prior to Tuesday, prior to them coming in and testifying about it. That's why in the second case, it's different. Another question, can you be a conspiring witness at all on witnessing a sentencing? Sarah, can you just elaborate on that? I'm not sure if I follow the question.
Yeah, it seems like you can't be an aiding and abetting on testifying that there's been a sentencing. The only thing you're going to get is lashes, period.
You're saying this is Ishiata Yochel Hazima.
Like even in the case that's about to come up, right? If you testify that he stole on Monday, but really he stole on Tuesday, mm-hmm. you're going to be punished as if he stole, right?
Yeah.
But if you testify that he was sentenced for stealing.
Right. So I see what you're saying. And that could be problematic because what would be a case where the conversation revolves around when a sentencing took place, is there ever possibly Adam Zoman on it? Yeah, I can't think offhand. That's what it sounds like. Jeremy,
but the sentencing is verifiable. If I'm the judge and a witness comes in and says this defendant was sentenced to death in another court, if I want to make sure that I'm doing justice, I can, you know, send my messenger out to that other court to find out whether in fact there was a death sentence issued. Whereas the other situation is the witness comes into the court and says, I accuse this defendant. I saw him with my own eyes. He did it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other way to verify that. It's not an official proceeding.
Well, a shliach, you see, what you're suggesting is that they send a shliach, that they send an agent to the first court to verify it. But why should that shliach, why should that one person be any better? You know, even if it was two people, what makes them any better than the witnesses we have in front of us right now who are testifying?
I can go myself, though. If I'm the court and I have a witness who tells me that a death sentence was issued in a different court, that's still verifiable.
Right. I mean, the thing is in the Torah is that two witnesses is believe, unless we have reason otherwise, two witnesses are accepted as admissible proof and as absolute proof. We have no reason to, once we do drisha v'chakira, and we cross-examine the witnesses and everything comes out fine, we have no reason to doubt them. That's considered an absolute proof, an absolute raya in halacha. So, I mean, imagine, like, every time you need to verify something from another court, those three rabbis have to take a trip over there. It's not practical either, I think. But also, forget about the practical element, two witnesses, many times in the Torah, I'll be shnayim edim yakum davar, that two witnesses are the gold standard when it comes to it.
So then it gets back to my question about proximate cause, which is, would the witnesses, if it's false testimony, mm-hmm. if the two witnesses have conspired to tell this court that this defendant is already subject to a death sentence in another court, would the penalty for that revelation, assuming it were true, be to put another death sentence on this defendant?
So it wouldn't be so much, right. I don't think we would view it so much as putting a new death sentence on, but rather carrying out the previous verdict. I think that's how we would conceptualize it.
And if there were no previous verdict, then they would be essentially conspiring to put him to death.
Yes. That. Oh, interesting. Okay. I want to discuss this further, but I realize we have less than 15 minutes left, and we need to get to the bottom of the Ummin a little bit further. So I would love to discuss this more. So for everyone who I say this to, I really mean it. If I ever say I need to cut a conversation short, reach out to me. I'm more than happy to delve more into it outside of our 1 hour that we have. So I apologize. Okay, so now that we learned about this principle of distinguishing between testifying on the action versus testifying on the sentencing, we're going to see this play out not just in capital murder cases, but also in cases of theft as well. So the chen le'inyan tashlumei knas. So the same thing applies when it comes to penalty payments. They say, the first pair says on Sunday, they saw someone steal somebody's cow, Bessie, and he mercilessly steals her, butchers her, and sells her on the market. On Sunday, and the second pair comes in and says, wait, on Sunday you were with us. Rather, on Monday, we saw him steal the cow and sell it on the market. So Ms. Shalman, so then they have to pay. Even if the second pair says, we saw him steal even earlier, we saw him steal on Friday, still the witnesses, the first pair of witnesses will be guilty for trying to impose a fine on the defendant. Same principle over here. Because until this point, we had no reason, Basin did not have to impose a knas on the defendant. But the first pair of witnesses tried to impose a knas before such a verdict even existed. So they are the cause of that knas. So that's why the defendant will still be guilty based on the testimony of the first of the second witnesses. But the first pair of witnesses will also be guilty because they made up the entire thing. They fabricated it. And the same distinction applies here. So let's say two witnesses come in. They say on Sunday, he was sentenced on Sunday for theft, and he should have to pay kafel. He should have to pay twice the amount, the principal, and then the principal twice as a penalty payment. He was sentenced on Sunday. Then the second pair witnesses come in and say, no, rather on Friday he was sentenced. Or even, even on Sunday or on Monday, he was sentenced. On Monday he was sentenced. Ain Mishalman, they do not need to pay. Why? Same principle over here. It's exact same case. Just swap murder with theft.
And well, so excuse me, I think it's I think it's four and five times, right? Because it's the
depends what kind of animal we're talking about, right? Oh no, you're right. Four or five times, right? So are we talking about a sheep? We're talking about a cow, right? So was it four times from sheep, five times from the cow, right? So, right. Or if it's a different animal, then it's kafli, right? That's the importance of ganav tavachu machar, that because not only did you steal it, but you chopped it up and sold it, there's an extra penalty of four times the amount for stealing a sheep, five times the amount for stealing a cow. So, Henry Shkoff, thanks for pointing that out.
Rabbi?
Yes, Sarah.
In either one of these cases, whether you're lying about when the action took place or when the sentencing took place, there's no forgiveness for I mixed up my days. I mean, if you think about the trauma of watching a murder take place, right? It's got to be traumatic. And then you're going through the trauma of going to court and saying, I watched this murder take place. And I say Sunday instead of Monday. Hmm. There's no forgiveness for that?
So I think you're right. You know, if they are initially talking and it slips out of their mouth, they accidentally say Sunday instead of Monday, I don't think we hold that them accountable. But the way my understanding the process works is that there's cross-examination. They isolate both witnesses. They talk to both of them. They get the initial stories from them, and they make sure that they are consistent. both witnesses are saying the same time on the same day, and they have everything coordinated properly, it's hard to believe that that's a slip of the tongue then. That sounds a lot more deliberate. I could believe, you know, one guy, you're right, it's a traumatic experience. He saw a murder take place. He can mix things up. But for both of them to have all the same details lined up properly and for that to be a mistake, that's a little bit more difficult. That's a harder pill to swallow. So I think there's a much lesser chance of that taking place. That's probably why. But I agree with your point. There are cases where somebody might slip up and the base then has to be understanding of that. Okay, so now I want to get to the question that we raised earlier that Jenny asked for us. We're now going to analyze the second part of the Mishnah, and we'll see how far we get. In the second part of the Mishnah, so remember, crazy case. We have this first pair of witnesses that become Edom Zomim based on the testimony of the second pair. But then the second pair turn the third pair, fourth pair, fifth pair, up to 100 pairs and more into Edom Zomim as well. So Rabbi Huda says this is becoming a circus over here, a travesty. So what does he say? What does Rabbi Huda say? Rather, only the first pair of witnesses are put to death, but we don't believe the second pair to turn everyone else into Edom Zomim. Well, the Gemara asked, turn the page on the Hamad Beis. We're on Hamad Beis, yay, making good progress. If we're concerned that they are plotting, afilu kat rishona namilo, even the first pair shouldn't be put to death then. What's going on? If clearly they're not credible, why do we believe them in regards to putting the first pair of witnesses to death? The first pair should be exonerated as well. So Amar Rabbi Avo shekamu baharigu. What's the case that Rabbi Yehuda is dealing with? He's addressing a case where the first pair was already put to death. Well, then the Gemara says, Maida hava hava. Well, that's just a mistake then. But that's not a ruling. So Rabbi Yehuda can't be talking about a case where they're already put to death. Like Shkleach, they're already put to death. Okay, I know I can't do anything now. We're talking about, obviously, where they weren't yet put to death. El Amar Rava hachi kamar, im ina lakat achas nehergis, iikatfei in inaharigin. What's Rabbi Yehuda mean? If there's only one pair that they turn into Edom Zomim, then they're believed on that one pair. But they're not believed to testify against any additional pairs of witnesses. Well, that shot makes sense in terms of logic, but it doesn't fit with the wording, with the formulation. Habil Vakamar, he said only the first pair is put to death. That implies there were other pairs as well that they testified against. So Kasha, it's very difficult to understand Rabbi Yehuda's position, but it's very clear from the Gemara that we are not satisfied with invalidating the second pair's testimony against all the other pairs, but accepting their testimony on the first pair. That doesn't work, the Gemara says. Okay, so we didn't really get a satisfying answer from the Gemara, but the Gemara at least validated our concerns. It validated our question on the Mishnah there. Okay, question. Should we try to get to the next Mishnah, or do we want just like a short idea to wrap up over here? Those who are interested in getting to the next Mishnah, raise your hand. I'll just take a quick vote. Okay, so we're not. Okay, so we should end around here tonight. So I'll share one idea with our last 5 minutes instead of doing a quick rush to the Mishnah and then only a quarter of us understanding what the Gemara is saying. This is interesting. So I have this sefer over here called Nitzotzei Hashas. It has very nice little vartlach on the Gemara. Usually not halachic. They usually take halachic concepts and they make nice divrei Torah out of them. So less a Thursday night shiur, more like a Saturday morning sermon kind of Torah. So here is the question, and it plays into our Gemara very nicely. Remember last week we talked about how we could split up money between witnesses, we could split up restitution, but we can't split up malchus between the witnesses. And we asked, why can't we split up malchus between them? So the Beis Halevi and a number of Achronim answer, because it's cumulative. 13 lashes is not the same as 39 lashes, because with each and every ensuing lash that I get, it becomes exponentially more painful. So when I split it up three ways, 13, 13, 13, it's not the real makos, because the 38th lash doesn't feel much worse than the 37th lash. It's a cumulative experience. So to limit it means you're not getting the full punishment. So he has like this nice little idea over here. From Agon, Rabbi Daniel Chaim Alter Shlita, who apparently is a Hasidic Rebbe, an Admor of sorts. So it says in the Gemara Megillah that Yaakov Kirishmi of Esmishtaim Shana, that Yaakov Avinu separated from his parents for 22 years. Ukenegdon Nitzar Mimeno Liros Espino Yosef Esmishtaim Shana. And that's why his son Yosef was taken away from him for 22 years. Uh-huh. Now the Marsha asks, that's not fair. His mother, Rivka, told him to leave, to flee from Esav. So he was supposed to leave the family. And in fact, the years he spent at Yeshiva Shem Ve'Aver that we're told, that also was a legitimate pursuit. So why was it that he was punished for 22 full years? That's not fair. He was doing a mitzvah. He was actually fulfilling Kibbutz of Aim, even though he left his parents for 22 years. Why was he punished for that?
Same as the lashes. Yeah.
What was that? Well, he doesn't get lashes. You'll see where we're going with this.
Yeah.
So he says, Achein lo nenash al esrim hashanim behen shaha beis Lavan kitzivo imo. Yaakov wasn't punished for the years he spent residing in Lavan's residence because his mother told him to go there. Ach kafisha gemara meris hu hashta b'darcho habaisa od shnatayim kach sh'al shnayim elu nenash. He, on his way back to see the parents, he spent 2 years dallying along the way. So he's only getting punished for 2 years, not for the other 20 years. Now the question is, wait a minute, why is he getting punished then that Yosef is taken away from him for 22 years if only 20 of those years he was supposed to be away and the other 2 years he delayed seeing his parents? So send Yosef to Egypt for 2 years and that's it. Why 22 full years? So comes along this Admor and tells us we can learn from the principle of Makos. Because with each and every ensuing makkah, it becomes harder. It's cumulative, the punishment. So too the pain of Yitzchak and Rivka not seeing their son Yaakov. Because after 20 years, it wasn't just another 2 years. It was year 21. It was year 22. And 21 years is way harder than 20 years. And 22 years is much harder than 21 years. And because of that, Yaakov was punished a full 22 years, because if Yaakov was separated from Yosef for only 2 years, he wouldn't feel the experience of his parents, which was a feeling of 21, 22 years. And he takes that idea from the Makos. That's, I don't think, 13 lashes to the witnesses to split up, but they each had to get 39 lashes so they could feel the experience of the pain that they tried to wrongfully impose on that defendant. That's a really
other aspect.
Yeah. Sorry, I apologize. If anyone needs to go, it's 8:30, so by all rights, you can log off now. I'll remain on for a few minutes to take my grandfather's question and any other thoughts and questions you all have. Anyone who's leaving, have a wonderful Shabbos. Zadie.
Okay. He just was, I'm trying to reconstruct my thought. Yeah, it wasn't that after 20 years, he decided to go back. He probably would have stayed a lot longer in Lavan's house if it wasn't for the fact that Lavan, as he expressed it, is looking at me in a hostile fashion. And so it wasn't a motivation that he wanted to go home to his parents. It was a motivation that he wanted to get away from his father-in-law.
Right. So just with this whole Dvar Torah, I should clarify, when I say it's a Chassidish Dvar Torah, Henry knows what I mean. Chassidish Dvar Torah are, I know it sounds terrible, but it's kind of true. It's like a step away from Purim Torah. You're not supposed to take it seriously. I think that's how it's intended. You know, it's like these things that I'm quoting from here, they're like meant to be amusing. They're taking a concept, learning a Gemara, like, oh, let me connect it to this kasha from the Marsha on Yaakov Avinu. So I wouldn't get too caught up in the minutia of it. It's just like an amusing thought that I wanted to share that I saw at the end of the shiur. But I wouldn't get too caught up in that, if that makes sense. It's Chassidish Torah. You know, Purim's coming up. This is good to share on Purim. So I'm sharing in advance of Purim. I should clarify that.
You know what I have as a noisemaker for Purim?
What was that?
You know what I have as a noisemaker for Purim?
Yeah, you have your revolver.
Right.
All right. Anyone else have any questions before we go?
I have a question, Rabbi.
I have a question. Henry.
At the end of the Gemara, we were just learning. Why does it not ever discuss, right? You have one pair and then another pair and another pair and another pair and another pair. When do we stop trusting this pair that comes and said, you were with me, you were with me, you were with me, you were like, when do we stop trusting them?
Oh, that's a good point. You're right, because it's clear to us that one pair isn't crazy, but 100 pairs is absurd. So you're right. Where do we draw the line? At what point do we say this is a mockery, this is a circus? I don't have a clear answer. I can look that up, by the way. I'll try to see if the Rishonim discussed that. But you're right. You know, where do we draw the line between 1 and 100? I don't know.
I mean, at some point, you got to say they're the ones that are wrong.
Right. I think the part of this is that the Beis Din needs to, you know, not be. It's part of jurisprudence that they have to get a sense of what's going on here. You know, why are they so quick to just turn the next pair of witnesses into Edom Zomamin? So I'm not sure if there is a precise number. It might just actually be telling us that Beis Din has a license to work outside of the strict halachic parameters and say, yeah, you guys are two witnesses. You are valid. You have a valid testimony, but we see something is amiss.
So they can do this. They don't have to do this.
Right. So it might be left in the hands of Beis Din to make that determination. And what Rehuda is saying is that he encourages Beis Din to take their heads out of the Shulchan Aruch and actually look at what's in front of them as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Good question. Any other questions? Okay. Yashar Koach. We're on Ham and Bays. That's good news. Having a wonderful Shabbos, everyone. And remember, if you can't make it on Shabbos, we have Parsha Zachar laning tomorrow at 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. That will be Zoomed. So check your emails for that. Have a good night and a good Shabbos, everyone.
Bye, Shalom.